time for Yakety Science. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the laboratory, the Skinner box, and the cyclotron. We are the show that finds the merry in your mammalogy, the ornery in your ornithology, the intrigue in your ichthyology, the here-here in your herpetology. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College, and your humble host. First up, as always, the Shaggy to my Scooby-Doo, Associate Professor of Chemistry at Tulsa Community College. Say hello to the nice people, Matt.
Raro.
You're Shaggy. I'm Scooby-Doo.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And our guest host today is Doug Mock, Professor Emeritus at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of numerous publications in ornithology and behavioral ecology, with a particular focus on family conflict. He also had the misfortune of being my undergraduate advisor at the University of Oklahoma. I did research on cattle egrets with Doug many, many moons ago. We'll be hearing more about Doug and his work later in the show, but for now, what's up, Matt?
I don't. Do you see this gruesome wound I have on my hand?
Could you stop dripping blood all over the place?
Right? It's awful, isn't it? No, it's actually really nothing. It's like a paper cut. But yeah, I got it from a really unlikely source in the kitchen. I cut myself.
Shark. Shark attack.
Not shark attack. No, there are no sharks in my kitchen, believe
it
or
not. You agree that would be unlikely.
You're right. So factually correct. Good guess. However, no, I cut myself on sugar. Can you believe it?
Given that it's you, I can believe it, Matt.
That I would cut on something so sweet. No, I had a dried sugar in a jar, and apparently it dried, and then when I opened the jar, it kind of sheared off that layer of sugar in a way that turned it into like this wicked blade.
So you had a saw, a sugar saw.
And so then when I was like rubbing my hand on it to like clean it off, I sliced my hand on it. I got like basically like a paper cut, but from sugar.
From sugar.
That's the exciting. More injuries in the kitchen lab. At home. Mm-hmm.
I was actually bitten by a shark.
Have you been?
Right here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Wait.
And no, this did not happen out at the aquarium. This happened in the zoology lab, right, during dissections. So even though the sharks are dead, their teeth are still sharp. And so if you accidentally rub your hand the wrong way inside the mouth of a dogfish shark, it will cut through your glove and it'll cut through your skin, right? So I had a cut on my hand from a shark.
That's wild.
Okay. Anyway, it was nothing serious, but I got to walk around and say, you know, people ask, what happened to your hand? I'd say, shark attack.
I mean, it's true. Yeah. It was. What you from beyond the grave.
What's important is to not give any details after that point. Just leave it at that. I don't want to talk about it. It's very traumatic. I went down to Norman to see the Natural History Museum.
Oh, and the dinosaurs there.
Sam Noble Museum. See all the dinosaurs there. The Pentaceratops and I think it's the Apatosaurus that they have there. And the big theropod predator that they have in there. The Saurophaganax. Saurophaganax, that's what it is.
Do you have a favorite dinosaur, Brian?
Yeah. I'm partial to the flying ones, to the pteranodons. I like the big crests on things like the Pentaceratops. So how about you?
Thank you. Thank you for reciprocating and asking
about
my favorite.
Well, I don't really care, but you're gesturing at me, so I'm going to ask.
I also like the Triceratops. Very nice. I think that's from, watching Land Before Time as a kid.
I get all my dinosaur knowledge from Dinosaur Train. That's why I like the Pteranodons.
Sure, right. Yeah. Or the Ankylosaurus. You know, those are fun. With the club tail.
Yeah.
Those are fun. Mm-hmm. Or the Stegosaurus. I mean, classic. Oh, and speaking of the Stegosaurus, do you know what the name is for the little spiky bit at the end of the Stegosaurus' tail? It's called the Thagomizer.
That's from the Far Side, isn't it? That's Gary Larson.
Yeah, Gary Larson called it the Thagomizer, and he had made this joke about, this it got thag. We'll call it the Thagomizer. Apparently, the scientists decided, you know what, it's as good a name as any, and it is the official name of that part of the Stegosaurus, is the Thagomizer.
All right, anyway. How about some headlines?
Let's go.
First up in the headlines, we have the big news of the week, of the month, of the decade. That's right. Cracker Barrel is changing its logo. honestly, there's so much to unpack here, so much that is mystifying about this story.
Brian, I think you are thinking about your other podcast.
Wait, where am I?
This is Yakety Science.
Not Yakety Corporate Logos?
No.
All right. I have so many, right? I get lost.
I guess so. Right. I mean, okay. Yes, it is news. Cracker Barrel got rid of the cracker and the barrel from its logo.
All right. So what's our headline here?
Oh, it's something about lithium.
Yeah, that's right. So lithium, right, as a treatment for Alzheimer's. So Alzheimer's has been one of these really stubborn disorders that we've been working on for decades. We haven't made a lot of progress, especially when it comes to treatments for Alzheimer's. From an article just published in the journal Nature, they found that lithium levels in the prefrontal cortex were higher in normal individuals, that normal cognitive individuals, than individuals that had mild cognitive impairment or a full-blown Alzheimer's disease. They further found that lithium was sequestered in the amyloid beta plaques that have been one of the key signs of the development of Alzheimer's, have been associated with Alzheimer's. So those plaques are taking up lithium, and then other parts of the brain then are becoming lithium deficient. So this is all from human studies, and it's correlational. So they're going into mice models here, and they are looking at the same thing.
Mice models? They're like on the runway? Mice models,
they're yes. Like, they're on the runway in Milan, and they scoop them up from the runways, and they put them into laboratories. They looked at these mice, and they found the same patterns with respect to these lithium levels and plaques. And so they found the same patterns. And then they performed experiments in which lab mice were fed either a normal diet, or had normal levels of lithium, or one in which the lithium levels had been dropped by about 90%. And they saw in these mice that were lithium deficient, they saw the development of plaques at a higher rate. They saw a decrease in cognitive function and memory. And they saw changes in gene expression in the hippocampus, which is an important area of the brain for memory, that matches the changes we see in human Alzheimer's patients.
So our suggestion then to listeners is to grab all the batteries, all the lithium batteries you can have, and just go to town, just chomp them up.
That's it, right. That's our advice. Suck on a lithium battery.
That's right. Right.
No, it's not, and we are not at the point yet where we are going to just be blanketly giving lithium to the entire population.
I mean, it solves other problems.
Right. I will say they've done a study in Denmark that looked at the occurrence of Alzheimer's in different populations within Denmark based upon their water supply and how much natural lithium was in the water supply. And they did find that where there is more lithium, there is less cognitive decline. So that's at least some suggestive research
there.
And I think RFK Jr.'s head is just going to explode because we're going to remove all the fluoride and then we're going to be putting lithium into our water supply. The other thing to note here is that, hey, you know where this research took place?
Where did it take place?
It took place at Harvard University. So most of the people involved in this study were at Harvard University. And the research that was done here was funded by grants that have been cut now. The laboratories that are doing this research have been downsized. So
if you or anyone you know is being affected by Alzheimer's, which is, you know, pretty much everyone, get mad.
We are attacking science different ways.
We're attacking our own future.
All right.
How about a lighter topic?
Lighter topic, right. So here's something new in Uranus news.
Ooh, I do love hearing about Uranus.
I know you do. It's really a little disturbing. So Shakespearean scholars threw up their hands in exasperation this week. "We're not miracle workers," shouted one angry Oxford Don. "Shakespeare wrote a finite number of plays." Why were they so angry, Matt?
I guess it has something to do with the fact that we just love naming all of Uranus's moons after Shakespearean characters.
That's right.
You know, Oberon, we had Titania, Bianca, Desdemona.
Yeah, there's a whole long list. A lot of them from A Midsummer Night's Dream. There's another bunch that are from The Tempest. Also from Alexander Pope. So I should say that the quote from the Oxford Don was completely made up. That was all just silliness. It's true. But there are a lot of moons, right? There are a heck of a lot of moons.
There's a lot of moons.
And a lot of them are really tiny. So you kind of push the definition of what is a moon. This one, which hasn't gotten a name yet and is still just going by S2025U1, it's only about 10 kilometers in diameter, and it orbits about 35,000 kilometers from the center of Uranus.
I'm sorry, from what?
from Uranus or Uranus, whatever you prefer. You say tomato, I say tomato, right?
People say tomato are wrong.
Don't be a pronunciation Nazi, Matt. Outside the ring
system. It's not about pronunciation, it's about cowardice.
It's about cowardice. Well, don't be a cowardice Nazi, Matt. Outside, I can be cowardly if I want to. It's orbiting just outside the ring system and between Ophelia and Bianca. So this makes it one of the smaller inner moons that orbit inside of the five main moons, which include Oberon and Titania and so on, which are a bit farther out. So do you know how they discovered this one?
Oh, this is going to be our boy, James Webb Space Telescope.
That's right, the JWST.
That's right. They did not find that with Voyager 2 or all the other probes we've sent to Uranus, because it's small. And it does not have much albedo.
Well, maybe they should get its testosterone levels checked.
It's what? Albedo, not libido.
Oh, albedo. Okay, all right.
The albedo is the reflective quality of an object.
No, I'm aware.
In case the listeners don't know, the albedo is the reflective quality of an object.
If something's shiny.
Yeah, see something in shiny.
If it's shinier, then it has a higher albedo. If it's dull, it has a lower
And so
albedo.
If we're looking out into space with our telescopes and our probes against the blackness of space, it's hard to see something that does not reflect something, you know.
So, and it doesn't help that it's pretty close. It's dark, but it's also pretty close to the kind of light of the rings.
Still exciting. It's always nice to find a new family member. All right, what's up next? I'm ready to learn.
Up next, we have a dragonfly that really loves a crappy human-befouled habitat. Who could love a sewage-filled urban pond with floating diapers, crack pipes, and copious amounts of pond scum? Well, meet the blue dasher. These dragonflies are able to tolerate these degraded urban environments. So they have the ability to tolerate hypoxic environments, high bacterial loads, extreme heats, which you get in urban environments, desiccation, drying out. And they have a high dispersal capability, especially in the eastern United States.
What does that mean, dispersal?
That means they can go from one place to another. So they're adapted to these urban environments. And those urban environments they're not all right next to each other. And so they're able to, you know, leapfrog from Pittsburgh to Philadelphia to Newark. They've done a genetic analysis of these guys, a population genetics analysis. They've looked at particular gene variants that we kind of know what they're all about, what the genes are all about. And we've identified some specific ones that seem to allow them to thrive in these environments. There seems to be a combination here of perhaps them being pre-adapted already. There seems to be some genetic change happening as well, too. So there's some sort of more recent evolution that's happening here where they're becoming better adapted to some of these urban environments. And that makes them, you know, very, very common, right? So if you see a dragonfly in the city, it is very likely, you know, even here in Tulsa, it is very likely to be a blue dasher.
And it's very pretty.
Yes.
You can't say that it's seeing a dragonfly, a nice pretty dragonfly. It is a pretty dragonfly.
It is very nice.
As long as you don't look at its penis, apparently. Oh, my God. What is this thing?
The other thing to mention here is that the name of this species is Longapenis, which sounds a little bit like the Swedish chef saying long penis. This is referring to its genitalia, and that brings up the whole topic of dragonfly genitalia, right? Which is connected to dragonfly mating behavior and mating systems, which are all really very interesting and bizarre.
He says interesting. I say horrific. I'm looking at a picture of this thing.
Well, I mean, first off, have you ever seen dragonflies or damselflies mating? They form what's called a wheel.
Yeah,
a mating
the little
wheel.
Loop so looking thing.
What happens is that the male has these little claspers at the end of his abdomen that grabs the female behind the neck. And then you'll see them kind of flying around together. And then when they actually mate, the female curves her abdomen all the way around, kind of to the midpoint of the male. And that forms what looks like a little heart, or it's sometimes called a mating wheel. And that's when the mating's actually happening. So that's kind of an interesting way of doing things. And sometimes they just mate very briefly, and then they separate, and the female goes off and lays the eggs. Sometimes the female goes off and lays the eggs in water, and the male will be kind of guarding her and making sure no other males come up. Sometimes they stay connected together for a very long time, and the male uses its penis to kind of clear out sperm from any other males that previously mated with the female. So There's this sort of sperm competition that happens. The female has a very complicated reproductive tract to try to keep the male from doing this, and the male has lots of little doodads and bristles and hooks and things on the ends of its penis to try to get out all of the sperm of its competitors.
I think I liked it when I knew less about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be kind of a theme of this episode. I wish I knew less about biology. It's all so dark and weird. All right. Up next, we need to take care of last episode's sound science puzzler. Here it is again for your consideration.
Since if you don't worry about it now, it's too late later on. And so in this issue, as in so many other issues, we are passing on extremely grave problems for our children when the time to solve the problems, if they can be solved at all, is now.
Yes, that was Carl Sagan talking about the problem of climate change. And that was back in 1985 in testimony before Congress. And the gee whiz here is supposed to be, the gee whiz moment is to realize that he was talking about this that long ago. He was actually speaking to a Senate panel, and on that panel was one of the big champions of climate action, Al Gore, back when he was still a senator. But, you know, four decades ago, we had the outlines of what was happening here. And you can go back farther than that. We understood the basic scientific principles of this in the middle of the 19th century. We understood, and we have understood this, and we keep saying, well, you know, we'll deal with it tomorrow. All right. Up later in the show, we'll have a new sound science buzzer for you.
Totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's totally natural thing in it. It's.
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 indeterminate units of time. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and potentially argue with Matt about his rating. Today, Matt drops down to the third row and takes up sodium, atomic number 11. Take it away, Matt.
That's right. It's sodium, the most delicious element. When you eat salt, when you consume salt, right. What you're tasting is the sodium ions, not right. The chloride ions,
right.
Just yeah. The sodiums.
I was going to say some people like it more than others. My wife will actually take like a tortilla chip that already has salt on it, and she'll take a salt shaker, and she'll shake salt on it, and then eat the tortilla chip.
That's the way my mother-in-law is. Oh, my gosh. She is. I've joked that we should just buy her a salt lick, like you give it to deer,
that's right.
And just like put in her living room.
Hey, that's an anniversary gift. I've got an anniversary coming
there
up.
We go, see? There we go. Fantastic. All right, so the name sodium comes from the Latin sodanum, or the Arabic soda, which, oddly enough, both mean headache, mm-hmm. Because sodium was used as a sodium carbonate was a known headache remedy.
But you also have the word natrium from
yes,
Latin.
Natrium and natron, which are both the Greek and Latin words for it. And that's why we have the symbol. And first element on the periodic table to where the chemical symbol and the English name don't match.
Right.
So sodium is monoisotopic, meaning there's only one isotope of sodium. It's sodium 23 with a whopping 11 protons and 12 neutrons.
Excellent.
Excellent. So you're wondering, of course, does this mean that it has a flat, even atomic weight number?
I don't think that, because you have disabused me of that notion on many occasions.
That's
in the past.
True. Yes.
Protons and neutrons do not have exactly one atomic mass unit. This is a lie that we were told by our chemistry professors.
That's right. And then reinforced when our biology professors
that's right.
simplified the glory of chemistry for us.
I don't think we can be held responsible. If we were deceived by duplicitous chemists and then we shared that knowledge with our students, I mean, I don't think we're really the ones who ultimately are responsible.
It's true.
Here.
Sodium, which has 11 electrons, explosively wants to get rid of that,
that's right.
that 11th one and go back down to 10.
Explosive.
What's so cool? Yeah. It is explosive. Have you ever thrown sodium in water?
I have not, but I've watched any number of YouTube videos of sodium being dropped in water.
It is very impressive.
And in toilets, too. There are guys that dropped it in a toilet once and broke open a toilet.
I mean, that's what would happen. Yeah. I have blown up beakers on accident when I use them, but you know, that doesn't always happen. Mm-hmm. But no, it does. You put sodium in water and it will react with the water to give off that electron so forcefully that it will self-immolate and explode. There is a layer of sodium atoms in the upper atmosphere, about 50 to 65 miles above sea level in the lower mesosphere. We get it because there's ablation of meteors. Meteors come in, they burn up in the atmosphere, and any sodium atoms that are in that level actually stay as atoms, just kind of aloft in that area of the atmosphere. If they fall below, if it happened below there, then they end up falling all the way to the ground. But the funny thing is the use of this. So sodium has a whopping one valence electron. So when it's excited, we can use it because it only makes a single wavelength of light. Okay, it's at 589.3 nanometers. It's that yellow-orange light that you get when you burn sodium.
Sodium lights, yeah.
Yeah, sodium lights. Sodium, you get them for street lights and stuff like that. And so we can use that in reverse. If we shine that wavelength at sodium atoms, it will excite them. Mm-hmm. And they'll give off that light as well. So since we have this layer of sodium atoms floating around at the 50 to 65 miles above the sea level, if observatories with big telescopes shine a laser of that wavelength,
that particular wavelength,
into the sky, it will cause an artificial star to appear in the sky. Oh, cool. And they use that to calibrate as a reference point for their equipment so that they can get really clear shots because they know how to stay aligned.
Could you do skywriting that way too? Could there be like a message like,
oh, that'd be wild,
like,
wouldn't
eat
it?
A Cracker Barrel?
You would need a whole bunch of that. It's not like it's going to stay glowing. You'd have to like, you know, write it out really fastly.
Yeah, but I'm sure you could.
Maybe if you like raster, you know, yeah, it actually could happen. Let's do it.
Okay,
let's get ourselves a sodium laser.
It's a startup business.
Absolutely.
Sodium laser advertising.
Yeah, advertising well above all those
that
planes
would be,
with the
that
flyby.
That would be SLADS, sodium laser ads.
There we go, SLADS. Let's open up SLADS. Let's get our Kickstarter going.
For SLADS Incorporated.
Absolutely. Uses of sodium, not very big. No one uses the element for really anything other than coolant for, like, nuclear reactors. Mm-hmm. Because it is just so freaking reactive. How do you use it for anything?
Don't they use it in solar thermal systems as an absorbent, right?
It's the thermal medium. It's actually a salt, though. It's sodium chloride.
Oh, it's sodium chloride.
Yeah,
okay.
So metallic.
So you're saying just sodium by itself.
Yeah, metallic sodium does not have many uses, but they will use it in in certain types of nuclear reactors. But in compounds, goodness, I mean, good luck finding something that doesn't have sodium in it. Sodium chloride, of course, is the most, you know, delicious salt out there. Sodium hydroxide, NaOH, is the ace of base. It is like the, you know, that's lye, right? That's sodium lye.
The ace of base,
absolutely. And so it is like the number one base you can ever use. Or it's just a counter ion for pretty much anything out there. So it's just it's a great element.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to add in biologically here. Sodium is really important. Sodium ions are really important in terms of things like nerve impulses. And the sodium-potassium pump is a really important transmembrane protein that, active transporter across the membrane. So lots of sodium biology going on there. There's a reason that it's so delicious because we need it.
We need it.
For all of these different processes. And
we crave it.
And we are unfortunately in an environment where it's hyperabundant, so we actually end up consuming
way more
sodium than we need now, and that throws off the balance within our system. But it is really a key essential part of biological systems.
Indeed. I like it very much. I'm going to rate it pretty highly. I'm going to give it, I don't think I talked about any downsides other than like excess consumption of it, but like, what a great element. 5 stars from me.
5 stars. You know, there probably have been people injured in sodium explosions. So,
but that's awesome.
It's awesome when people are injured by exploding sodium. Matt, you heartless jerk. You rated it 5. I'm going to rate it 4. So it's going to average out to 4.5.
Fantastic.
Excellent. All right. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, sodium.
We have, what's number 12, Matt?
Magnesium.
Magnesium. Excellent. All right. So we look forward to that on the next episode of Yakety Science. Our guest on Yakety Science today is Doug Mauch, Professor Emeritus of Research Biology at the University of Oklahoma. He's the author of a long list of publications in behavioral ecology, as well as the popular science book, More Than Kin and Less Than Kind. Doug, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're probably best known for your work on siblicide and brood reduction. Sibling conflict is something that I'm sure many of our listeners can relate to. Was a personal experience an inspiration for you as you started your research career?
Well, you mentioned the popular book, and I dedicated it to my brothers, my older brothers, specifically because they'd had their shot at me. I was the fourth of four boys, and so the basic principles of sibling competition were not obscure to me by the time I started studying it. Yeah. My first grant from the National Science Foundation was actually to study why birds are monogamous. And the proposal that I pitched to them was just all about that there should be, in some cases, a conflict of interest between the male and female and what they want to do. I also said that the family really is a dynamic of multiple dimensions of evolutionary conflict, that there should be conflict over limited resources among the siblings because they're growing extremely rapidly and all of their food has to be bottlenecked through what the parents can deliver.
You all were talking about siblicide. I was under the mistaken, you know, impression that this was about psilocybin.
Not psilocybin, no.
So siblicide. Would you mind, one of you biologists, mind defining siblicide for the chemist and for the audience?
Basically, it means fatal sibling competition during a period of dependency. So if they're, in the case of the egrets that I studied, there's a linear dominance hierarchy set up that the ones that are slightly older peck the ones that are slightly younger and intimidate them. And if there's not enough food for everybody to survive, the youngest one dies and dies in a relatively efficient way without consuming a lot of limited resources. Cainism, it was originally called because of the story of Cain and Abel in the Bible, and it's been called fratricide. But I started using the word siblicide because it's gender neutral and Bible neutral.
So yeah. If we back up and give the audience the framework for understanding this, which is that you expect there to be competition between them, but it's constrained competition because they do have an interest in each other's success. And that's all governed by Hamilton's rule and the idea of inclusive fitness. So could you give us a basic background there?
Okay. Hamilton's rule in inclusive fitness is talking about the limits on which close genetic relatives should be either kind or nasty to each other. And so if they are, in general, if there's a food shortage and there's food enough for two and there's three of us and we're not related to each other, then there's going to be a limitless fight over food, and the dominant stronger ones will get the food and will survive, and the weakest one will perish. If they're close genetic relatives, then it gets a little more complicated because it's not clear that you want the youngest one to die, because that youngest one is going to be producing nieces and nephews that will enhance your inclusive fitness, your broadest possible Darwinian fitness. There was a quip made in 1955 by a population geneticist who said, "I would risk my life for two brothers or eight cousins." And the formal nature of Hamilton's rule was not published for another 8 years after that. So I sort of imagine this joke being said, and then 8 years later, everybody catches it and laughs.
He probably felt cheated. It's like, I came up with this implicitly. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. True of a lot of ideas in science, that they're out there half articulated.
You alluded to earlier, there's not only sibling conflict, but there's conflict between the parents and the offspring and between the parents themselves. But can you tell us a little bit more about that broader conflict that happens?
Well, parents in general, unless they're going to be permanently mated to the same partner for life, which does happen in a very few species of swans and geese and things. But in most cases, if your current spouse disappoints you in some way, there's the possibility of what humans would call divorce, but just pairing with a different partner next time if you have unsatisfactory results with the first partner. And so that sort of thing happens, and it happens in house sparrows. And what we found with house sparrows, this is work done with Trish Swagmeyer, what can happen is that It's usually the female who divorces the male, and she does so if the babies from their nesting effort turn out to be undersized.
So if
So
the male shirks in terms of his responsibilities, she dumps
if
him.
basically if the male is out chasing skirts, so if he spends too much time out there and does not also bring home lots of food, then she jilts him and takes up with somebody else. And the sex ratio in house sparrows is male biased because they're bullies during the winter when food is hard to come by. At a feeding table, the male house sparrows will bully the females and take more of the food. So females die more during the winter. But this means that if a female divorces her partner, she has a plethora of alternative partners from which to choose.
Interesting. Do you have any questions on
No, I love it. And now I'm concocting all sorts of stories in my head about what's happening at our feeders. And I'm going to look at all these male sparrows in the winter in a different light. Yes.
Different light.
Well,
That's right.
that's the danger of studying biology, is that you see the beautiful butterflies flitting about through the field, and you see the beautiful birds that seem to be sort of harmoniously flitting about, and then you realize that it's this it's horrible unrestrained battle that's taking place. So,
It does not help you with your cynicism problem. You also mentioned the parent-offspring conflict because there's another part of that whole dynamic that the parents and offspring do not have identical interests. I had predicted boldly in my proposal to the National Science Foundation there seems to be fatal sibling aggression going on among the chicks, and according to the theory of parent-offspring conflict, the parents are certain to interfere with that, and that will be the first demonstration of this theoretical construct of parent-offspring conflict. The first day in the field, we get out there, the babies are fighting like hell, the parents are standing on the side of the nest preening, and you think, one of
Wow.
those great moments where you think, oh boy, my prediction was completely wrong. But then the more you think about it, the more you realize, no, it gets much more interesting, because then you realize that the parents are the ones who set up the hatching asynchrony that creates the dominance hierarchy. And why would they then break up the fights that they have established?
And they rig it because they begin incubating as soon as they lay the eggs, right?
That's
And
right.
so those
That's right.
eggs are going to hatch out in a staggered way. Whereas other things, and people may be aware that, like, you look at a robin's nest, those are all synchronously hatched, right? Because
No,
they're not. Am I wrong?
no, no. There's one that is a day later, typically.
Oh, really? Interesting.
That's the one that's going to go down if somebody goes down. We followed 1,000 broods of house sparrows, and 420 of those had brood reduction. So the parents start incubation the day that the penultimate egg is laid. And so those
Interesting.
embryos get a thermal advantage and a head start. The other one hatches a day later, and in 42% of the nests, somebody dies, and it's usually that youngest chick. The most disturbing detail of all, the victim, if it's going to die, it dies by day three. Day three, the babies are so unformed and so weak and feeble and passive, they can hold their bills up and they can open their mouths and they can vocalize. That's all they can do. They can't even jockey for position very effectively. So the decision is being made here for the little one to die. That's being made by the parents.
Yeah, no, that's grim.
Okay, so the catch-all term is brood reduction for all of this.
That's
And so
right.
you have siblicide. What is the word for when the parent is doing in the child? Infanticide.
That part hasn't been focused on. Uh, there,
Okay, all right.
there are a few cases of documented filicide, as it's sometimes called, of
Yeah.
where there's a storks are known that they sometimes just pick up the youngest one and toss it off the side of the nest, and so that has been filmed. But that I was very alert watching for that with egrets. But with egrets, the youngest one gets pecked and brutalized to the point where it sort of loses its grip and falls to the ground. And it's, 4 feet beneath the nest. And it's down there vocalizing, and the parents can hear it. And they just ignore it. You're not in the nest anymore. You're not going to make it. We're going to feed the ones that are up here.
And so there's conflict in all of those nests. There's jostling because the siblings always want a bit more food, but it's just that it doesn't become lethal unless there's limitation on the food. It doesn't really
Okay,
get to the point of
here
almost,
we
is
did an
that right?
experiment. Yeah, pretty much. We did an experiment on this where we doubled the amount of groceries at experimental nests, and we sham supplemented the control nests. So we would just chop up fish into small bits, and then take a piece of gutter, house gutter, 4 foot long section of guttering,
Slide, yeah.
and you put a wallop of chopped fish on the end of the gutter, and you reach it over to the nest, and you invert the gutter, and manna from heaven comes down on the experimental nest, and the babies there, then they gobble, 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 gobble. At the control nest, it's an empty gutter that is lifted up, and you turn it over, and of course, no manna from heaven falls out. And what you find out is that the experimental nest, question number one, do the bullies peck the victim less often? Answer, no. No, they're just as abusive as ever. But the third chick, the C chick, survives more often, significantly more often, because it gets a part of that food that goes onto the floor of the nest. And so they survive more often, but they get beat up just as much. And the parents don't do anything about that either. We did an experiment where we removed the sea chick to see if the fighting would stop, where we simply let them fight and we got a base rate of fighting rates. And then at the experimental nest, we just grabbed the sea chick out of the nest and took him back to the lab and fed it. And at the control nest, we took him out of the nest, gave him a kiss, and put him back in the nest. So they had the same amount of handling. So what happens is you have high fighting levels going on during the pre-treatment period. 3 days of pre-treatment, you establish a baseline of fighting level. Then at the experimental nest, there's only two chicks there, and the fighting level drops 90%. Control nests stay up at the high level. You do that for 3 days. Then after 3 days, you restore the sea chick that you've been keeping back in the lab, back into its nest, and the fighting rate goes right back up to the control levels. And we did that for a 3 day, 3 day, 3 day. We called this the Easter miracle design because 3 days after the sea chick had died, a miracle restored it to life and the dynamic resumed.
This is how avian religions begin, right? So the sea chick is restored, manna from heaven, right? You've got all of the elements right there.
Praise the Lord.
So, Doug, you've been studying birds for decades and decades. What sort of advice would you give to budding ornithologists who are maybe thinking about going into birds who might be listening?
Made much more complex by the fact that support for science is cratered, but I have to believe that that's going to be restored in the next administration, and that science will, American science will go through a period of difficult recovery. I would say learn theory. Science is not important unless you're trying to refine theory. The full siblings destroying each other is a pretty big sacrifice of Darwinian inclusive fitness. So I was aware of that, and I sort of knew what to look for. And that came from having had a theoretical preparation.
All right. What have you been up to more recently, Doug? I know that you've been working with shoebill research, shoebill stork research. Those are really strange and interesting looking birds. I've never seen one in the wild. I've seen hammerkops in Senegal, but I have
Oh, very nice.
never run into shoebill.
Okay. Well, you won't find shoebills in Senegal. They're
Right.
only on the Nile. They're in
Right.
papyrus marshes of the Nile, and they look like storks, and they were called storks for years. The DNA has recently revealed them to be really bizarre pelicans.
They
This
look
is a
kind of like a
regional.
clog has been shoved onto their face, for those who haven't
It
seen them
looks
before.
like a clog, yes.
Yeah.
And that is the question I'm asking is, what the hell is that bill all about? And what we've, found out from a bit of reading and from a couple of trips to Uganda, they eat fish that have to breathe air.
So
This is
lungfish.
lungfish in particular, but also some catfish and some other things. And they come to the surface, average about every 30 minutes, 24 hours a day. They come up, take a gulp of air, and they go back down. And so this bird, it sits on floating vegetation. It's a big bird. It stands 4 or 5 feet tall, weighs 14 pounds, which is a
Wow,
lot
they're
for a
giant.
flying
Yeah.
bird. And it sits there with these enormous long toes that it spreads out over the vegetation, and it rests back on its heels on this floating vegetation. And it basically watches a hole in the vegetation. It's waiting for a fish to come up to breathe. And when it does, it grabs that fish with this huge bill. And my thinking on the bill, the bird strikes before the fish reaches the surface. And so it has to deal with refraction. And so my basic hunch is that the enlarged bill is a correction for bad aim. But then there may also be advantages for prey handling of after you grab hold of this fish. The lungfish is an eel-shaped fish, and it is covered with slime. And when you strike, you end up coming up with vegetation and mud and fish. And so you've got to do a certain amount of jockeying around to get rid of the mud and the vegetation, hopefully still holding onto the fish.
So one of the superpowers of the field biologist is patience, I think. And those shoebills have to wait quite a while for something to surface before they strike. And that means you have to wait quite a while as you're observing them. So how many actual strikes did you observe in the
38, 38.
38 over the course of how many hours of
Yeah,
observation?
far, far more than 38. No, that's right. And that's why I have to go back for a third field season, is I want to get that number up a little bit.
You haven't taken your own advice here. You always told me pick a species that was, sample size city where you house sparrows, cattle egrets, so you don't have to struggle. You've
This
got
is
one you have to struggle with now.
retirement science.
So. Slow science,
It's an
right? Yeah.
excuse to travel.
It is. There you go.
Yeah,
Yeah. Right.
exactly.
Yeah. If you need a field assistant, I think Matt and
Yeah,
I
there
will
you
both
go.
be
I've
happy to
had
come
any
along.
number of offers for field assistance.
Yeah.
But I've got to tell you how this study started. During COVID, I was amusing myself by playing music on the internet, and a guy in Uganda started watching me, and he started writing to me saying, I like your music. And so he and I started just a casual correspondence, and I said, well, what do you do in Uganda? He said, I'm a tourist guide. I take people around through East Africa. And then he said, and I'm also the director of the Save the Shoebill Project, which it turns out he had invented. I told him, well, I had been offered a chance to study shoebills 45 years ago. And he said, well, then you should come to Uganda and study them now. And that literally was the beginning of our collaboration. And he wants a descriptive study of shoebill biology because people love shoebills. When they find out what the bird is really all about, we're hoping it gets a bunch of publicity and builds interest, and that can then help save the shoebill, unless they get loved to death by the tourist business. That's part of the dilemma of studying a bird in Africa.
Right. So, and you alluded to there your other main activity in retirement. It's not just doing research, but also making music. So you
Music,
are an
yeah.
accomplished folk singer. So.
Well, that's what I was. That's how I learned how to teach, basically, was playing music in the 1960s in coffee houses. And so I learned how to manage stage fright, and that proved to be very useful to me.
Yeah, we are performers, aren't we? I mean, get up there on the
Yeah, yeah.
stage.
I think teaching at its best, teaching is a form of performance art. The most effective teachers can usually find some way to make it something other than just ladling of raw facts, which is why you're doing Yakety Science.
That's right. Yeah,
That is the point.
that's what we are trying to do
Yeah. No,
is be entertainers and educators at the same time. So
you've already prostituted yourself. That's no longer a negotiation.
for vast amounts of money that you
Exactly. And
imagine,
you've impressed dozens of followers.
fame is just crushing us. I mean, we can't walk down the street these days.
No. The groupies and autograph seekers will find you wherever you go.
That's right. Me more so than Matt. I mean, honestly,
Yeah.
obviously.
Obviously.
No, biology has that sex thing going.
Yeah, we're the sexy ones, right? Well, Doug, this has been a great conversation. It's been good to catch up with you and
Okay.
hear your reflections on the past 50 years and what you've got going on right now.
It's
So,
been it's fun.
take care.
So long. Nice to meet you, Matt.
Nice to meet you.
Ironikos prosphilos eleluth.
Up next, we have our brand new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some other way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. Okay, that is it. That is your sound science puzzler. Let's have it one more time. All right, very good. That's it. So, something to reflect on your voyage home tonight. What could that sound be? What could be making that noise? If you think you know, please email your answer to yakitiescience@gmail.com. Of course, be sure to include your name, your phone number, your social security number, your date of birth, and your mother's maiden name. All of those are very much appreciated.
And hey, speaking of our email address, listeners, you are welcome, encouraged even, to send in your science questions to yakitiescience@gmail.com. We will tackle whatever weird science questions you have.
So you're allowing them to send in puzzlers to us now.
Yes.
This seems like the universe has been inverted. The world turned upside down.
Try to stump the yaks.
Stump the yaks. Oh, that's very good. All right. Okay. New segment here, stump the yaks. So in the subject line of your email, you should put in stump the yaks. And if you actually do manage to stump us, then there has to be a prize of some sort, don't you think, Matt?
I mean, something beyond just honor and glory.
Yeah.
No, Brian has
keychain.
A keychain. Wonderful. No, actually, Brian will Venmo you $200.
Only if Matt Venmos me $200 first. But I can promise a keychain. All right. Well, we look forward to your questions, and we will have the answer to this sound science puzzler on the next episode. Well, that's it for this episode of Yakety Science. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a scientist of note. This episode's quote comes from Richard Dawkins, the evolutionary biologist, author of The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, and many, many other works. Here's the quote. After sleeping through 100 million centuries, we have finally opened our eyes on a sumptuous planet, sparkling with color, bountiful with life. Within decades, we must close our eyes again. Isn't it a noble, an enlightened way of spending our brief time in the sun to work at understanding the universe and how we have come to wake up in it? This is how I answer when I am asked, as I am surprisingly often, why I bother to get up in the mornings. With those inspiring words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
See you next time.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakitiescience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. So what I'm going to say is let's go back and do the Thagomizer clean.
All right. Clean the Thagomizer. I'm going to clean it.
Let's clean the Thagomizer. Let's go back and clean the Thagomizer.